Thank you, Dr. Grace, for hopping on to this call. And for those listening, you are a neuroscience expert and you studied the brain. And you basically help people who have neurodegenerative diseases?
My specialty at the time was in understanding treatments and discovering treatments for neurodegenerative diseases. So my research was around why they occur and how we can mitigate the process of further degeneration.
Exactly. So you mentioned ALS and other diseases, right?
Specifically. Yeah, ALS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, that spectrum of disorders where it degenerates over time.
Sure. And is dementia part of that as well? Dementia?
Yes. Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, those are on one spectrum of disorder.
Okay. Very cool. And so, yeah, I wanted to just, you know, chat and learn from you today about how our brains work and how you're able to help people who have people who are, you know, mental health is a huge issue. I know that's related or whatnot, but basically how the brain works and how we can help optimize it. What are some things that you've done? So Sarah, welcome to the podcast and feel free to share your background, why you got into what you're doing today and things like that.
Sure. Well, neuroscience, for me, neuroscience, the seed of getting into this field was planted at a very young age. What happened was when I was 8 years old, my nuclear family, so my parents and my brother, were involved in a car accident. My mom was driving and she had it was a head-on collision and she was in a coma. So she had brain trauma and I was the next one who had the more severe injuries. And I basically broke my neck. So it was a high cervical dislocation, some fracturing, and I nearly ended up a quadriplegic. And at that time, there was a lot less known about the brain than there is now, but still there was nothing that they could help her with. She was in a coma and she passed away. And my own recovery for my near spinal cord injury was a year long where I had the halo brace and I had to learn to walk again. So that was when the seed was planted. And then fast forward into college now, I'm in my bachelor's degree after high school. And that was my first foray into neuroscience research. What I had done was an undergraduate dissertation and in a neuroscience research lab that studied methods on how to restore the spinal cord. So in other words, the ultimate goal was to, if someone had a spinal cord injury and they were in a wheelchair, the ultimate goal was to, well, how can we make them walk again? So I was involved in that research and that's how it happened. It was just a very personal decision, wanting to help people like my mom and myself and those less fortunate who did have a severed spinal cord. And I was lucky, very fortunate not to have had that.
Yeah. So, you know, what are some things that you've learned about the brain that we could treat and why it degenerates and how, you know, what are some things that make it degenerate? What are some things that you can prevent it from doing that? My grandma personally, both of my grandmas, they have dementia and to some degree. And I think that happens with old age because, you know, things are repetitive, you know, every day is like the same and they don't have much to do. And so like, what are some ways that you help treat your patients and what people can do to work on that?
Yeah. So just to let you know that I'm not currently working with patients, right?
Sure.
I was more back in that time, I was on the research side of things because my credentials are as a PhD. So I was not a medical doctor. So I don't work with patients, but what I did do was I led some research projects to make new discoveries on the brain, right? And one of the most phenomenal discoveries in the brain in neuroscience is this whole thing around neuroplasticity. It used to be a long time ago that we believed that brain cells don't regenerate and that they stay the way they are and things are quite static. And what we're learning now, and we have a lot of clues into it and even a lot of details around this, is that our brains are highly adaptive and they're very plastic. And when I say plastic, I don't mean the material plastic. I actually mean that there's a lot of capabilities of rearranging to happen, right? There are neural connections to rearrange and adapt to senses, maybe like senses that were lost or senses that were underused and therefore have, or even senses, neural pathways that were strengthened through practice and through practice and through training, through very specialized training. where plasticity can happen in those cases where certain new connections are formed and they can be further strengthened, further enforced. And therefore that leads to mastery, where you're using a lot less mental resources and cognitive resources to perform something. And that's how we achieve mastery.
Okay. And so I want to know, like, how, like, from all your years of studying the brain, like, what are some of the most fascinating or interesting things that you've learned and that people can implement to better their brain and things like that? Yeah.
Yeah. So that's definitely one of them. Knowing that when we dedicate, when we commit, and when we dedicate ourselves to master a certain skill, that there are actually neurological changes that happen in our brain as a result of that. And so this is the movement, the way we experience it on the outside is, first of all, when we're learning a new skill, you know, we fumble, it's difficult, you know, we sometimes take 3 steps forward and 2 steps back. And then because we have to, and it takes so much of our conscious effort whenever we're doing that thing. And then over time, when we practice the right thing, notice that it's not about practicing anything. It's practicing the right thing. When we practice the right thing, we practice what works. And what happens is eventually we will move from needing to put so much effort into it into all of a sudden it's unconscious competence. It's like in the beginning, when a child learns to tie their shoes, they have to put all their effort, concentrate on it. They can't do 2 things at the same time. And now all we do is bend over, we can tie our shoes, and we can do a bunch of other things at the same time. We don't even have to think about it. And the reason why is because the networks that were involved in that example, tying your shoelace, have become so enforced that all of a sudden our brain does not have to expend any energy on that task, on that skill. And that is the path to mastery. And there's neurological changes that happen every time we learn something new, and we learn it to the point of mastery, right? Sure. And so that's phenomenal. And when you recognize that, it's where you can have a lot more, be more conscientious and more cognizant around, where am I at in terms of how conscious I am when I'm performing that skill, mm-hmm. right?
So I guess for the people that you have treated, what are some exercises that they've done to help them strengthen those pathways? Like, what are some things, for example, if you have ALS, I know you just have to help them repeat certain motions or repeat certain words, right? So is that what you mean by that, repetition?
Okay, so it's very different when we're talking about a healthy individual, when we're talking about a healthy individual wanting to achieve mastery, versus if we're talking about an individual who has been diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disease and they're at advanced stages. Those two are very different approaches. Because someone with ALS, that is a motor neuron disease, which means that they have their muscles have atrophied and there's difficulty in motion, not because they don't know how to. It's not about practicing, you know, something. It's that there is a physiological thing that's preventing them from being able to have volition, you know, voluntary control over their muscles. So that's very different from what can we do to help them practice. It's not about practicing, because the disease progresses. It's progressive. And so that's very different from a healthy individual, showing them the steps that they need to take to practice the right thing so that they can achieve mastery. Two very different things.
Okay. And I have a question too on, you know, there's, I don't know if you've done research on this, but, you know, things like shrooms or psychedelics and even things like, you know, medical marijuana, like, how does that affect your brain, and how, like, does it make you think differently? I know there's different neural pathways that are blocked and different ones that are open if you do certain drugs like that, like, you know, shrooms, weed, stuff like that. So, like, what's your, from your research, how does it affect people, and what are the effects on the brain?
So that's outside of the realm of my research back then, because I didn't study substance effects on the brain. However, I will say that there is currently a lot of research on medical marijuana and magic mushrooms. I think that's what you're referring to. And they do, like, anytime you introduce a substance, what happens is that the way the body receives it is there's some sort of receptor, right? Mm-hmm. So a substance comes in, when we digest it, inhale it, inject it, whatever the method of introduction is. And then when it reaches the target, you know, and it crosses the blood-brain barrier, there has to be a receptor to receive it. And sure. The receptor is a natural receptor that already exists in the brain. So if that receptor is receiving that external substance instead of what it normally would be receiving, then there is some sort of an influence on the natural pathway of what that receptor would have done absent that substance. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Right. And that's the central dogma of human physiology and biochemistry. That is what, you know, that's how we know what, that's how we begin to study and understand what substances, what effects they have on the brain. And so that's what I'll say about that. And generally that is what happens. And for each of these substances, they affect different, they affect different cellular pathways, right? They affect different, when we say pathways, we're talking about messenger systems, and they're at the molecular level.
Okay. Molecular level. So, so from your research, you know, like I said, what, like our brain, I think people, scientists are still figuring it out, right? There's so many things we don't know about the brain. And I heard like even one slice, you know, of your brain contains like millions of neurons and things like that. And so, you know, what were some things as you were studying the brain were like, wow, that's fascinating. That's amazing. You know, you said neuroplasticity, anything else that you're like, wow, this is crazy. Like things that I'm learning about our brain, you know, obviously environment affects your brain, right? I think, you know, there's a quote, you're the average of the five people you hang around with. And it's also because of the energy and the mind influence you get from that environment. So just wanted to hear your thoughts on that. Yeah.
Yeah. So the original question was, what is something very fascinating that I studied about the brain, right?
Yeah. Just what are some fascinating things and
things
that you're like, wow, this is amazing.
Okay. So here's something that blew me away when I was involved in this project. And it was a project that I led across Canada. It was a nationwide project. And what we discovered was that when a patient is in a coma, when they are in a coma, there is a spectrum of comatose patients. You can have on one end of the extreme, we have patients who are brain dead. So in other words, if you put them in an MRI, there shows you see black, right? There's not a lot of neural activity. And then the other end of the spectrum are awake, healthy individuals like you and me. If we put me and or you or us under the MRI, there's a whole lot of activity, right? We see that in a functional MRI. We can individual spots light up in the brain where there is activity. And so that's what a functional MRI does. However, if you take a patient who is in a vegetative state is someone who appears to be in a coma. They have had some severe blunt trauma to the brain, not a puncture, but a trauma, like a car accident, for example, or a fall from a height on their head, like that type of blunt trauma. And now they are not awake, but they're breathing. Their hearts are beating. Yeah. They're right, but they're in a vegetative state. What we have discovered is that even though on the outside, they're not moving and they're not responding, under a functional MRI, their brains are still fully functional. And for some patients in vegetative states, we've been able to ask them questions in the MRI and they've been able to answer.
Okay.
Yes or no questions, of course.
And so usually they're what is the difference that made being under an MRI and hearing those questions? Like they're not supposed to be, like they're in a vegetative state, so they can't answer?
No, usually? Because they don't respond on the outside, but their brains are very much functional. So how we do this is that we put them in the MRI. So now they're in this, we slide them on a bed inside that big MRI machine. So their head and maybe the top half of their body is inside the machine. And then we turn it on, which is a functional MRI. So whenever a certain area of the brain is functional, then on the reading on the screen, we see that area light up. That's how it happens. So what we do is we tell them, we ask a yes or no question. And so, for example, if you were under that MRI, we would ask you, is your name Ray? Mm-hmm. It's either a yes or no question, but they can't answer yes or no. So in order to get that answer, we say, is your name Ray? If the answer is yes, then I want you to imagine yourself playing the piano.
Sure.
Okay. If the answer is no, my name is not Ray. If the answer is no, then I want you to picture your your sister, or picture your brother, right? And so you see what happens is that when you imagine yourself playing the piano, that mere act of imagining and envisioning the areas that you were light up, where you move your fingers when you're playing the piano, those same areas light up in the brain, even though you're not actually playing the piano, you're just imagining yourself playing it. Those finger playing areas in the brain light up. So if the answer is yes, we ask them to imagine themselves playing the piano. And so in yes, indeed, they're able to answer yes, because they are able to imagine themselves playing the piano, and we see those areas light up.
Wow. So, and this is just from scanning the brain and seeing which areas light up, right?
Correct. Functional MRI.
I've seen this video of a guy, and someone asks him a question, and he's just thinking in his head. He's just asking Google in his head, like they play something on his head. He's just asking it in his head, and then the answer comes out on the screen. And so just from his thoughts, it communicated through the device to the computer, and he just was able to read the answer. Like, you know, about things like that. And like, you know, there's going to be, you know, chips in our brain now with Neuralink and stuff. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a whole field. And we call that BCI, which stands for brain computer interface.
Okay.
Yeah. It's phenomenal. And I think that has a lot of potential to help a lot of people, and it could give them a better quality of life. You know, because you can attach those chips and have that thought move a wheelchair, for example. And so that increases greater mobility. There's greater independence, a sense of significance that can come out of it. And there's also a lot of authors who are able to write phenomenal books, create their legacy like that just by thought, right? So obviously, I think is a very positive change. Okay. Right? But always with any positive change like that, with any positive change that comes from new technology, there's always some ethical considerations.
Like what?
Well, like for example, if you have somebody who is unable to speak because they are in a coma, or maybe they have an advanced neurodegenerative disorder where they're unable to articulate. If you have someone who's unable to articulate, then that means that they aren't unable to give consent, right? So for example, if they can't give consent, then how do you ask the patient permission to receive treatment? That's very important in the medical world, is there must be informed consent.
Well, I thought I thought you said if you can ask them, say yes and imagine this and say no. So can't they give consent that way?
They can. Technically they can, but you have to remember that the medical care is also not just about the patient, but it's also about their caregivers, also about their family members, also about the whole medical care team. So in any topic like philosophy and healthcare ethics, it's impossible to have a unanimous decision. You can't have consensus. It's impossible to have consensus. So some family members may not feel that having a yes or no response in an MRI, some people don't feel that that is grounds for consent.
Okay.
Right? Because it's still not that person speaking, right? Okay. So then that's what I mean by there are a lot of ethical considerations whenever new medical technologies show up. What are the boundaries in which they should be used, right? What are some dangers in applying that technology to areas outside of what it was intended to be? Right. There's always these considerations. Exactly.
There's always, you know, the good and the bad you could use technology for, right?
Yeah.
I think one thing, this is kind of off topic, but like AI kind of really scares me, in that it even scares like Elon Musk, you know, someone who, you know, he's the richest man on earth right now. Not on earth, but he's the richest known man so far, right? But things like AI, BCI, I think, what is it called? Brain computer interface, BCIs.
Yes.
Yeah, BCIs, things like that. That's great for solving a lot of problems, but it's also great at doing a lot of damage, right? And I'm sure it could be used for a lot of negative things as well. So just what are your thoughts on that in terms of like the BCIs, and is that, you know, a good thing? How will it really help us? Exactly, and how will it be harmful as well?
Yeah, some of those things that I mentioned earlier in terms of giving patients a much greater quality of life, giving them independence, especially giving them a semblance of as close as possible to a life pre-injury, right? Or pre-diagnosis. And that's what a lot of people want. A lot of patients, especially the ones in more advanced care, right? What the main goals are generally is they want a quality of life. They want to know that they can still be independent. They want to still know that they can have control over doing things that they enjoy. And so
Exactly.
these brain computer interface, these technologies can allow people to write a book that they've always wanted to write, could allow people to move wherever they want to move without the need for a full-time caretaker. Right? So it's yeah, go ahead.
Or like Stephen Hawking, right? He kind of used something like that, right? Because he couldn't speak, so he used something like that, the
He
DCI.
did. He did. He was a very, he had a very advanced stage of ALS.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And someone at his stage of ALS, it was quite rare for them to survive that long.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
But he did a lot with his life, I would say, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And he went on, even living with ALS, he went on to create a legacy and he went on to continue to be his brilliant self. And so that's where I see a lot of these new technologies really helping people, really helping patients, and is in that dominion.
Okay, nice. So you said right now you're not seeing patients currently, so are you just continuing your studies or are you just retired? Like, are you enjoying
Continuing my
life?
studies. No,
I mean, not
absolutely
co I mean not I mean not continue your studies as in for a doctor, but just like, you're always learning, right, as well. So I don't know what you're currently doing now.
You're right, correct. I shouldn't be so quick. You're correct. I am always a student. I am a student of life. So I'm no longer learning in terms of going to college, university, formal education, but I have never stopped learning since. So
Nice.
absolutely, I am a student of life. It is not formal education that I'm involved in. It is self-education.
Exactly. Nice.
Yeah. So I'm in the business world now.
Okay, and what is it you're working on now these days? What's some projects you're working on? Some things you want to raise awareness for?
Yeah, so in my business, because I've gone through so many years of college, one thing that I see is a lot of students who are trained at their higher education level. They're so skilled, they're so educated, and yet they believe that the value of their knowledge is nothing more than finding a job, right? Going to college, doing well in college, and then finding a good company to work for. And they believe that that is the only path that they have to be able to make a contribution in the world. And oftentimes, and this is what I went through too, is that after my PhD, there's this a huge amount of pressure to land a faculty position. But you have hundreds of students graduating in 1 year, and there's not a lot of faculty positions that open in institutions. And yet, students who are so skilled and educated, we feel like, well, we'd be a failure if we didn't get one of those positions, if we didn't become a full tenured professor. And it is such a shame that there's so much knowledge and there's so much expertise there, that expertise and knowledge, when delivered the right way, could really make a huge contribution to the world. So that's what I'm passionate about in my business, is showing people how to take what they know and what they do and their life experience, how to take that and package it, and how to monetize that so that they can make a meaningful contribution to their fullest potential, and they can also make a reliable recurring income.
Wow, that's awesome. And so, so I mean, I know there's a couple other people who are doing things like that, but so you basically help people package their passion, their knowledge, and monetize it so they could turn their passion into profit, pretty much, right? That's
Correct.
what it sounds like.
Knowledge to profit. Yeah. I'm not really a big believer on follow your passions. And I have a bunch of podcast episodes on why you shouldn't just
Yes, tell us more about that, because
follow your
you need
passions.
money, you need profits over passion, right? Profits over, not over, but like you definitely need to make income if you want to survive. So
Actually, no. The reason why I say that don't follow your passions I mean, that advice is very abundant. Follow your passion. Just find your passion. Go follow that.
Gary Vee says that. Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the thing about passion. When we look at passion, the etymology, the root word of passion, right? The root word origin, I should say, of passion comes from a word in Latin, which means suffering. And here's why it means
really?
Suffering.
Really? I didn't know
passion,
that.
Passion means suffering.
So what's the Latin root word called?
Passionem.
Passionem?
Yes.
That means suffering.
It means suffering, right? And here's
like
why.
Okay.
And here's why. Is because a passion is nothing more than a very strong and intense emotion about something. Mm-hmm. And when we have that strong emotion about something, it is basically the amygdala, the center part of the brain, which is the limbic system, the emotional, what some people call the animal brain, the mm-hmm. reptilian brain. Some people call it that, right? It's that
reptilian
part of the
brain.
Some people call it that because it's more primitive. That area of the brain is more primitive. So it's kind of like acting on an impulse because you have such a strong emotion on it and you're acting on impulse. And what that does, it bypasses the rational center of your brain, which is behind your forehead, which is the executive center. So what happens is when you follow your passion, you're following this really intense emotion, which is a very primitive structure of your brain. And the rational executive decision is not there, because you are just following an emotion. So that's why people who keep following their passions end up suffering, because passions tend to change a lot. They tend to change. And so you're following something that changes with the wind. And that's also why there's some degree of suffering that goes along with it, because you follow one thing. And if you don't do one thing for very long, if you don't commit to it, it's hard to get the result that you desire, right? But then again, some people feel like, I don't think I'm passionate about anything. And then they feel like there's something wrong with them. Or they have the other end of the problem where I'm passionate about so many things. How do I know which one to choose? And so I say, don't follow your passion. Instead, look for what is your definite purpose. And your definite purpose is involving that rational why. The why is in the executive center of your brain, which is in the forehead. And it's not there when you're just pursuing a passion.
How does someone go about finding that the purpose? And, you know, I think that's something not many people go around asking in life. You know, they just like, hey, let me just pay my bills, get a job and, you know, retire, have a nice family, have a nice car, like the American dream, right? Like, how did you go about finding your purpose, right? And how do you help people do that? Yeah.
So those are two different questions. So how I did it was where I alluded to earlier, what happened was a seed was planted at a young age where neuroscience, because my mom passed away and I had a near spinal cord injury. So there was that seed that was planted and I went to do a dissertation in undergraduate. What happened was I was still under the hypnosis, the culture hypnotic mechanism of believing that I got to go to school, I got to get good grades and get a good job. And this belief I had all throughout my bachelor's degree, my master's degree, and halfway through my PhD. And that's the reason why most people go to school, is because they believe that's what I ought to do. That's what I should do. That's what I need to do because fill in the blanks. And they don't even know how that got there. They're so passionate about it. And yet people don't know why. It's kind of like politics. People are so passionate about it and you don't know why. It's just there. And it's because of this hypnosis, this hypnotic culture that was created a long time ago. And that is one step. That is the most important step in the framework on how to discover your purpose, is by recognizing which values are yours and which ones aren't.
Okay.
Because like you said, most people go through life, I got to pay the bills, you know, I got to pay the bills, I got to go to school, I have to find this, I have to do that. And anytime you say have to, that's an opportunity to have a bit more awareness and say, and ask yourself, who said that? And when you do the digging in the right way, oftentimes we find our parents in that conversation. Or our teachers, or some authority figure, like a church pastor or a professor or some institution that we respect. It's always an authority figure, an authority organization that we have respected, that we have admiration for. And we tend to they tend to inject their values into us, and then we adopt them.
Okay.
And we go through life not questioning, believing wholeheartedly that it was our values. And then one day, that's why you have what's called the midlife crisis.
Yeah.
That's why that happens. You know, they wake up one morning. It's literally a Josh. You wake up one morning and you just realize, oh my gosh, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't know how I got here. I just kind of stumbled here. I just kind of fell into this path. You hear that a lot.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. So it is an opportunity for us to explore every time we say, I should do this, I ought to do that. Mm-hmm. As an opportunity for us to explore deeper. Who said that? Was it my voice? Or was it somebody that I respected in the past? And is it really what I desire? Is it really what I was put here to do?
So yeah, like I said, how do people go about finding their inner voice? Because I was on a Clubhouse room yesterday. And we were actually talking about like self-love, right? And how we're always trying to be validated on social media and all these platforms, which is our ego, right? But then how do we go about finding our inner voice or inner purpose? Because even people who are very successful entrepreneurs, I feel like they don't even know their purpose still, you know? And it's like, but does purpose change? Like, is it the same? What would you say if someone's like, what's your purpose? And how would you go about helping someone find that?
Yeah. Okay. So there's like three questions there, I heard.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to ask one at a time. But yeah, just I guess starting with yours first and however way you want to answer. Yeah.
Okay. So my life purpose is to show college educated professionals how to take what they know and do, right? And who the college educated professionals, right? Who want to make a living and earn a good income just as much as they want to make a meaningful contribution on the world. And I want to show them how they can do that by monetizing what they know and what they do online. Okay. That's what I'm here to do, right? Because most of the times people say, well, it's not about the money. It's more about the meaningful contribution. But at the same time, they realize that they do want to make more than what they're making in their job.
Yeah.
Right. Sure. So I'm for the people who recognize that they're not getting paid their worth.
Yeah.
Sure. They have an awareness that, you know what? Wait a minute here. I'm worth more than this, but my job doesn't pay me what I'm worth. So they desire that exchange because they know what they can bring. But at the same time, they want to make a meaningful contribution. And it's not just about making money.
Okay.
My passion, my purpose, and my passion is to help those individuals to achieve that goal. So that's my purpose. And what was your other question?
So how does someone go about finding their purpose? How do you help people?
Okay, yes, I do help people to find their purpose, either in a career or in their business. That's what I do. So I would say that the first step to finding purpose is what I mentioned earlier, is to get clear on your values. Because no matter what you choose in life, it is aligned with your values. And values have a hierarchy, right? Your top three values, let's say, you live them out. And if your life and your career or what you're doing does not align with what you naturally feel are your values, then that misalignment will cause an emotion at first. And if that emotion is ignored, it could lead to sickness, which is how you have unfulfillment at first, right? You start with being really unhappy, and then it could lead to depression, frustration. And if left unchecked, that could lead to sicknesses. You know, there's an unlimited amount of sicknesses that could happen, right? Yeah. Not just depression, not just mental health illness. Some people can fall sick. Some people can all of a sudden have this inflammation and they lose their voice. Some people have indigestion and it just gets worse and worse, like these human sicknesses. And there's a lot of studies around this where if left unchecked and if we don't honor our values and we don't live in alignment with them over time, that could lead to even the incurable diseases like cancer.
Wow. Okay.
So there's a lot of studies on what is the origin of disease. And there's enough research that shows that it could be it starts with not that type of misalignment.
So is that like not living in integrity with who you say you are? Is that part of it or What are some things that
who you say you are? Some people don't know how to articulate that.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not about it's not about not living in alignment with who you say you are, because some people don't know how to articulate it. But the thing is, there's an inner being, there's inner voice, our inner soul, however you want to label that, that wants to venture out, that wants to be creative, that wants something more. Mm-hmm. Right. And we have been programmed to ignore it. We've been programmed to ignore it, but instead to follow the blueprint that has been set out before us. And the blueprint could be go to school, get good grades, get a job, or it could be, you know, do this, whatever that blueprint is. We've been given a blueprint by somebody that we respected, and we just accepted it. There are some folks who have been given this blueprint and it really was in alignment with their values. So then they're okay. But that's not always the case.
Exactly. And I think a lot of people, they just don't know where to look for. It's like, you know, they don't know where else to go except school, right? And get a job. And there's no other path unless you listen to podcasts or you educate yourself, right? And so, yeah, I mean, are there any tools that can help people for that? Like you said, find out your values and then find your purpose, right?
That's correct. Your purpose stems from your values.
Okay.
When everything you do is in alignment with your values, what happens is instead of feeling unfulfilled, you feel inspired.
Yeah.
Right? You are not bored if you're following your values. You're not bored. You are not, you don't feel unfulfilled, right? It's the opposite. You feel inspired. You feel like you always have energy to do that thing.
Right? Yeah.
You feel motivated all the time.
Yeah. Right?
You need to remind you. You don't need to set goals and keep reminding yourself. You just don't forget because you can't stop thinking about it.
Yeah. Okay.
That's what it's like to be living in your purpose and being on purpose.
So it's basically like work doesn't feel like work anymore because you're living your purpose. For your values, right?
Sure. That's the that's the more common way to state it. Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. Work doesn't feel like work anymore. Yeah.
And you're getting paid to do it, which is awesome. Which is like the ideal life, instead of like working a job you hate for someone and making someone else more rich, things like that. But
yeah, well, here's the thing. When you are inspired by what you do, you have a greater propensity to earn more money because you actually love what you do.
Okay. And your heart is in it as well, right?
Yeah, because naturally you will improve. You want to keep improving in that arena because that is where you're most inspired. So your potential to earn more money is greatly increased the more aligned you are with your purpose and values.
And values, okay. So I think values is important because I think some people don't ever even think about what are my values. So how does someone go about organizing what are my top values, you know, and how do you organize that? Yeah. And figure that out.
That's an excellent question. I'll give you a simple framework. Here it is. In one sentence, you will know your values by looking at your life and what's coming true. There's evidence for it already. We're just not trained to look for it. You know, and one thing that you can look for is in three different arenas. One of them is the space in which you live, in which you spend most of your time. The second one is where you spend your money. And the third one is what occupies most of your thoughts.
Okay. Right?
And I'll give you an example from the space perspective. If you look at the wall behind me, you see I have many degrees, awards, right? A lot of certifications and awards, right? So it's obvious in my space where I spend my time that I value education. I value learning and education. And I value it so much that I gotta always be the top, the best to win these awards.
Okay.
Right? So you see, your values are, there's evidence in your life already that are coming true. They're not something that you wish for. Values are not something you wish for. Values are already coming true. We're just not attuned to noticing it. One reason why is because we're too busy living out someone else's values.
Okay. So I guess the question is, how do you stop and recognize when you're living someone else's values before getting into that crisis? You know, like how does someone, I did this training called MITT, which is like this emotional intelligence workshop. And then they kind of have things that make you break patterns and break, like help you recognize yourself and be like, is this really what I want, right? So, you know, are there any exercises that people can do to be like, hey, like, what are my values? Or maybe I'm just living out someone else's values. And because they can change, right? Your values can change, right? Like over time as well. So
they can, but they're less likely to change.
Really?
Yeah, they can change. Your values and your purpose can change, yes, but they don't change as frequently as your passions will.
Okay. So your values are more steady since you're born then, or not since you're born, right? Since you're in high school, college, like,
okay, so feel like, for everyone it's different. I can't say, oh, it's this age or this age group.
Yeah.
For everyone it's different. But we all go through phases in life, right?
Yeah.
Right? In the first phase of our life, we are learning about ourselves and discovering what's out there. And then in the next phase after that, we are adventurous, we're exploring, right? And then the third phase, we're trying to build significance and some success there. And then the fourth phase, we are building a legacy and enjoying the harvesting and reaping what we have sowed.
Mm. Okay. Basically for the values part, like you said, figure out where you're spending your time, figure out what you're spending your money on, and just pretty much what's going on. And based on that, you could change your values, right? If you don't like what's going on.
Okay, so if you don't like what's going on, chances are it's not that your values need to change. It is a realignment with your values, an honoring of your values that needs to happen. Because chances are that if currently right now in your business, your career, your relationships, whatever arena of life, you're not happy with it, you're uninspired, it's not bringing the result that you want, chances are what you've been doing is not in alignment with your values. So therefore, that's why it's not producing the results you want.
Okay.
Yeah. If you, however, you can consciously tell yourself and make a decision that, okay, I know that my value is here, but I don't want it to be there anymore. And I want to be intentional about changing it. Then there is a longer process you can do to actually change your values. But that's, right, but that's a next step, is first being aware of what your values have been.
Okay. But isn't it fair to say though too, like you said, our values are kind of ingrained in us. For example, if you grow up like Christian, for example, or if you grow up Buddhist, those are values that you grew up with. But when you grow up, you might realize, hey, like, are these the values that I want? Or are these, you know, and they change over time. So like you said, we grow up without thinking. A lot of it is subconscious, right? From our parents, from parenting, from authority figures. But it's up to each individual to decide, these are my values and this is what I'm going to live by, right?
Correct. It is up for the individual to be aware of what have been the values. Like we naturally gravitate towards values. We naturally do. Our subconscious mind, our cognitive mind, our intellect doesn't need to make a decision that this is what I'm going to value. As we grow up, as we grow older, as we grow independent, we will naturally value certain things over others. We naturally have an hierarchy of
values.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We just have to discover what it is and be able to articulate it, and then be and operate in alignment with it.
Okay. It was interesting because you're saying, like, if you're not living in accordance with your values, then you're going to get certain diseases and like cancer, for example, which is crazy. But I guess our bodies know when we're not living in accordance with our values, things like that. Like, our, we just know that, our bodies, or subconsciously.
Consciously, so it may not be in our conscious awareness. And that's why you have people who go for years or maybe decades not living in line with their values, and they're not happy with it, but they just don't do anything about it, right?
Okay.
Right. So we have individuals who may not be consciously aware that what they have been doing is not in line with their values, right? And in those instances, you know, depending on how misaligned it is, if it's really severely misaligned, and the individual could feel quite miserable, quite depressed about it, like frustrated about it, if left unchecked, it could exhibit in it could exhibit physically.
Okay.
And that's where these diseases and ailments can show up. Chronic ailments, yeah.
Chronic ailments. So is the answer to curing disease really taking more pills and, you know, eating right? Obviously, yeah, that's part of it. Or is it deeper and, like, you know, are you living in accordance with your values and with what you say is important to you, but you're not, and that's why you're sick, for example, you know? So, yeah.
That's a great question. I love that question. The way that I see it is that medicine is true. Western medicine places a really heavy emphasis on medicating, right? Mm. Medicine, prescription medicine,
like,
medicating.
Like numbing yourself, painkillers, and
yeah, or medicating. Yeah. Right? And yeah. I will not deny that there is a lot of instances where medicine is necessary, mm-hmm. right? To help the body, to give it a boost, to help the body to rid something, to help the body to write something, right? I'm not going to deny that medicine is necessary in many cases. Mm-hmm. However, I will say that in medicine, I think it's important to recognize that health and wellness takes place on three realms, mm-hmm. right? The medication part of it is on the physical realm, where we look at our fragile bodies, what's going on with our fragile bodies, which area is feeling the pain, which area, which organ or area is malfunctioning, and how can we repair it? How can we restore it? So that's the physical part of medicine that people place the biggest emphasis on. However, I think there's two more arenas that could be better incorporated. One of them is from a mental emotional standpoint, because a lot of times the physical ailments and the sicknesses are a manifestation of something that happens first internally, mm-hmm. right? So there's that emotional, mental health, and then there is the spiritual one. So I think that when we are treating illness or sickness or ailments, chronic or acute, right? Especially mm-hmm. chronic, more so than acute ones, that it would be most helpful to be able to look on treating all three realms and not just the physical realm. I was going to say that I do understand that it's important. Quality of life is important. So treating the physical realm is important, and that might include medication to treat the symptoms that we are feeling, so that we are in a better physical place to be able to do the more longer term restitution actions.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is there anyone who's treating people like that? I know, like, there's some Eastern medicine that they do herbal medicine, but I don't know anyone who, I'm, this is the first time I'm hearing about, like, the three realms of, like, physical, mental, emotional, and then spiritual. Like, I don't know anyone who's doing that kind of healing.
Yeah.
It's either just, here's the medicine, the doctor, or here's the pastor, here's spiritual, or the therapist is, here's mental, but there's no one who integrates all three.
No, so I like, think that cool. I understand that practice is not, it may not exist. I'm not aware of it in one person, right? You know, or in one practice, it may not be out there. There's a three in one, but there are individuals who specialize in each of those realms. And I think the future of medicine would do very well to be able to collaborate and to be able to disseminate findings across those realms. It would be very good to do that. How you would coordinate it may be a really big feat, obviously, to coordinate that, you know, that those types of expertise. But since you asked the question, that's why I wanted to bring that up, my thoughts on treating sickness.
Nice. Yeah, no, that's awesome. Yeah, because the brain is one part, but the spiritual part is another, which you know, because people think, yeah, we're just a body, but we're not just a body. We're like a brain and a soul, right? Or spirit, you know, you don't call it spirit, something like that. But
exactly.
That's really interesting. But yeah, and so I think, you know, as we're nearing almost near the end of the interview, but are there any other things you want to share with the audience of just maybe some things that you want to share with people through your years of studying the brain and what you want to share with the audience?
I would say that I would encourage you, if you, for your listeners and your viewers, that if you're in a place where you know that you have a lot of knowledge and you want to share it with the world, and you know that you have something good inside of you, I would say that it is not only within your capability and your potential to do so, but it's also your moral obligation. Because if you believe in so much in what you do, and you know you have an important message to get out there, and it could change lives, it has the potential to be able to affect positive change, then it is our moral obligation to honor that purpose, to step up in that power and to honor that purpose.
Yeah, I think it's just a lot of people, you know, the biggest thing stopping people is self-doubt and fear, right? And so what would you say for people who are like, yeah, I know I have a greater purpose in me, but I just feel afraid because it seems so big, or it seems like I can't do it, or just, it just seems too daunting, you know? Like, what are some things you tell them and things like that, yeah?
I would say that anything new that you are to embark on will always be daunting because it's something you've never done before. So take daunting, the feeling of daunting, as a clue that you are on the brink of something. Because if nothing was daunting and everything was, that means that everything is familiar. And if you do only that which is familiar to avoid the feeling of daunting, then you will have more of what you already have.
Okay. So don't be afraid to go out there and push yourself, be uncomfortable.
You got it. Yeah. Yeah. And with that,
yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Where can people find you? You know, where can people connect with you? You know, where can they connect with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say connect with me on Clubhouse at Dr. Grace Lee. Or on LinkedIn at Dr. Grace Lee. Those are my top platforms. I have a YouTube channel as well. Also Dr. Grace Lee. And so if you want some inspiration, insights, tips, those are the three platforms that you can hear more about me and about my work.
And then you're also on Instagram, right?
Dr. Grace Lee. I'm on Instagram as well.
Awesome. And and you know, before we close this out, I always share this because you know, just something that, you know, like I go back to a time when I was like depressed and you know, before even starting this podcast, when I felt like just really low. So for you, think back to a time when you felt really low, maybe really down, depressed, like dark. Because right now, people only see the good part, right? Oh, like she's a doctor, she has all this, that's great. But like, you know, for when you were low, when you felt like no one was there and it just felt really dark, what's something that you'd go and say to your younger self? You know, like if you could go back in time and say something.
this is very personal, right? For me, back then, because of my history, right? So the history is that I didn't have parental support. After my mom passed away, I was an orphan and I became homeless. So for me, the one thing that I really wanted to have someone tell me was that everything was going to be okay. And was to affirm me that I have worth, that I'm worthwhile, that I have a lot of value, that I am valuable. That was the one thing that would have made the biggest change in my life. But that's a very personal thing because I came from a childhood that was very destitute. Mm-hmm. And everybody, I get that question about what would you tell your younger self, but it's a very personal thing. We all need to hear different things, to hear a different message because of the context of what we've been going through.
Exactly. So for you, it's you're valuable, you're worth it, things like that. And
I would have needed to hear that because what happened was when my mom died, my birth father didn't want me anymore.
Okay.
And that's why I was on my own. So that's why for me, it's very personal. What I would have wanted to tell my younger self is what I wanted to hear. What I needed to hear was that I am valuable.
Did you have anyone say that as you were growing up, or you just kind of had to say that to yourself and affirm that yourself?
I didn't have anyone telling that, and I was not able to confirm it myself because I didn't believe it
until now, maybe.
I was adopted later on as a teenager. I was adopted.
Sure. Okay.
And it was in that relationship with them. And of course, when I started to pursue my dreams, that I started to expand my horizon.
Yeah, but I think also that pain you felt of feeling like no one wants me made you achieve so much too. Like that pain led you to achieve greater things than you could have imagined.
Let us continue.
Yeah, no worries. We're wrapping it up.
Because I actually have a room on Clubhouse starting right now.
Oh, right now? Okay. Yeah, no worries. But yeah, thank you so much, for hopping on.
Let's continue though. So we can have a better ending.
A better ending? Okay. Yeah, let's continue then.
After. Okay. So just cut this part out and then we'll have a better ending.